G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another instalment of the U Project. Tiffany Ann Cook, good morning.
Craig Anthony Harper, good morning.
Are you all right?
I was about to say happy Monday, but it's not.
No, it's Tuesday. It's Tuesday. You had a big day yesterday. I had a big day yesterday, but that's all right. We're just up and at them. And I'm excited because, we're chatting to someone who's fascinating, Katie, but everyone knows my favourite podcast is Rogan. And last week I was listening to Katie, who we're about to talk to, on Rogan going, this lady is pretty amazing. She's done some amazing stuff. And then the next day you go to me, hey, you're chatting with Katie next week. Katie spots next week. And I'm like, I know that name. And I went, hang on. I went, the one that was on Rogan. And I said, what a small world that is. So here we are.
I'm like a little golden retriever, just
you are like a
dragging back the best people in the world and dropping them at your feet.
Yeah, you are. You're like a bloody golden retriever for podcasts. Hi, Katie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being had. How are you?
I am good. I'm amping up for another adventure. So every spare minute, I'm like training.
All right, we'll get to your adventure in a moment. Where are you? I mean, I know where you are, but tell our listeners where you are right now, what time it is.
Oh, it's evening. So I guess I'm a day ahead. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm in Portland, Maine. So
I think you're a day behind. So it's Monday night there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're Tuesday. So we're in the future. So welcome to the future. Let me just tell you, it's pretty good.
Well, I was on a flight once and I think it was my 36 hours of my own birthday from doing this event in New Zealand. So
it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of weird people who do adventure stuff and ultra endurance stuff and who are, you know, a little bit weird in a loving way, do you know who Lisa Tarmady is?
Oh, no. Should I?
No, probably not. She's more an ultra endurance runner. She's one of the world's best, but she's from New Zealand, and we've had her on a couple of times. She's amazing. So, what are you preparing for? What's your next big thing?
So last year I got really into like ultras and I joined the Coast Guard. So I had a few years where my training was more like I was constantly moving and didn't know where I'd be stationed next, but ultras have been like, especially ultra running has been a big part of like my training and really, I guess I caught the bug. So right now I'm looking to do 11 ultras in 11 days to raise funds for 11 water projects in Uganda. Mm. And I've been doing like last year with COVID and everything, I was just like, I don't want to do an event that's going to be canceled. So I kind of made up my own and started running across states. So I ran across three different states, and the longest one was 138 miles in about 33 hours. This is just like another state, but it's very different than anything I've done before, because it's one thing to like train for a marathon and ultra marathon, you do your thing and then you go and recover. But this is like running on tired legs. So I'm definitely excited to see how my body will react and also a little bit nervous, but that's kind of like, for me, that's the best kind of adventure where you're part excited and part like, what did I just like after like, training this weekend, yeah. Like, what did I do? Did I bite off more than I could chew? And I mean, that's what you go for. That's like the feeling of excitement and pushing the limit. And I mean, if I know I could do it, then what's...
Some people get excited about watching Netflix, Katie, but okay, you know, whatever. So I'm looking here at part of your bio. Yeah, so you ran across Maine in 33 hours, which is 138 miles, which in our language is about 220 Ks. So you ran 220 kilometers in 33 hours. Well, that's ridiculous. How... give us an... I mean... How do you keep your head and your body and your emotions and your energy and your focus and your attention where it needs to be? Did you sleep in that 33 hours?
No. Okay. So I find that sleeping would have made it more difficult because, like, I have so much like adrenaline and I have so many endorphins, and I have usually halfway through any of these ultra events, I start incorporating caffeine. And so when you add all those three, usually you don't even feel as much pain. So the pain that I feel usually happens like a day or two, sometimes even 3 days later. So I want to capitalize on all those feel goods to keep going. So I wasn't tired. And I don't even think I could have slept if I tried to, but, I mean, there's a lot of ways that people go about like wrapping their head around these big distances, like, you know, breaking it down 1 mile at a time or going to the next post or going to, you know, just counting to 100. And my strategy is probably the like most simple way, and I just don't think about it. Like, don't even do it, because what's beautiful about endurance is there's very few things in life that require, like, you don't actually need to think these thoughts, but really just feel your body and focus. So I don't necessarily, you know, think thoughts that make sentences. Like, I mean, usually I do when I look at the scenery and like absorb my surroundings, but for the most part, it's like focusing on my breathing and focusing on like, almost like you were driving a race car, like, okay, is this gauge working well? And sometimes I do listen to a metronome, which people are like, what? That is so boring, but it's, I usually try to keep 175 to 180 beats. And it actually helps with injury prevention because most people are more left or right leg dominant. And yeah. So over the course of 1 hour, you don't notice it. Over the course of 10 hours, I noticed in Ironman events that in my like finisher photos, it looked like my shoulder, like it destroys your body mechanics if you're only running and always running on your left or right leg. And it's something that you can correct by not being on one foot or the other longer. So the metronome just helps me focus on my gait. A lot of runners don't necessarily lean forward. So there's a lot of things you can definitely focus on: breathing, body position, your cadence, and then just fueling. Like, I mean, I'm pretty like, I just have a sports drink every 5 miles or every hour or so. So yeah. I don't really do a lot other than sports drinks, but I just,
is it like a meditation for you when you're, do you get in that kind of flow state where I think the challenge, for a lot of people, the biggest challenge in their life is one, managing their mind, and two, getting out of their mind, like being less cerebral. Like, I think the challenge, part of the challenge of life is critical thinking and being aware and all that stuff. But also part of it is getting out of thought, because when you're out of thought, like, it's awesome.
Oh, it is so.
In that non-thinking place where it's just your body and nature intersecting, and you're in this rhythm, and there's just all this stuff going on, and it's not about your mind anymore, and you're not solving problems, and you're not overthinking, and you're not creating bullshit in your head where you're just fucking in space and time, and your body's just moving through it. And it's like, this is it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, I'm like, if I don't need to think, why would I bother? Like, it's a vacation from all of that. And like,
oh yeah. A vacation from thought. That's awesome. Yeah. That's what it is. That's what ultras are. They're a holiday from bloody overthinking. Do you have like, obviously we want to talk about, you know, that little thing that you did rowing across the ocean. Oh, that thing. But I feel like, how many interviews do you reckon that you've done in your life? I know that's a weird question, but how many interviews, you know, where it's been you and an interviewer for somewhere between 10 minutes and 3 hours?
Hundreds.
What's the dumbest question? What's the question you hate?
Well, I hate the ones where they're like, you don't look like you could do that. It's more like the comments of like,
really?
Supposed to do with that? I think what they expect is like bodybuilders. I think endurance people don't necessarily look like there's veins coming out of there. So that one bothers me because it's like, what? I thought, I didn't know it had to look different. I mean, I'm okay with it now, but that's definitely as a female.
Well, it's kind of rude. Two, it's kind of judgmental. And three, it's kind of ignorant, right? You know. Do you work with an exercise physiologist or similar exercise scientist? Do you work with a nutritionist? Do you have a mind coach, psych? I feel like, you know, when you're telling me like 33 hours, I'm an exercise physiologist or exercise scientist by qualification, but I'm looking at all of this stuff and I'm thinking, did your central nervous system just crash? Like when you finish, does your body just go, I'm out, and you have 2 days of sleep? Or because eventually, because 33 hours of running and not sleeping and caffeinating and stimulating your nervous system, it's good to get the job done, but it's not good long term for health and recovery. So the pendulum's got to swing, right? What does that look like?
So I did have, and like most people who do 100 miles or 200 miles, they do it on trails. I did not. There's not even a trail that goes across Maine. So, and I'm more of a road runner anyways. So I did have edema, which basically if I wasn't on the road, I probably wouldn't have had that. But I did have that. And then the other, I guess, consequence of the choices I make in endurance is I had rhabdo. And
Really? Really?
That's how I feel. I was like, but I don't feel any. I don't feel rhabdo. But I guess they said that my creatine kinase levels were very high. So, I mean, I know people will like urine coke, and I didn't do that. And so, I don't know. I guess that is what they said, that it was very elevated. So they diagnosed it as that. But, I did say like to myself that I love running too much to go back to running right away. So I gave myself a solid month before I started running again, maybe even 6 weeks. And I get so much joy out of it that I don't want it to be this compulsive, like, oh, I got to run again. I wanted my body to really have time and honor the healing process. So yes, I did end that in a shape, but a part of me is still like, I don't know, fascinated and appreciative of like, I'm not going to tell my body what to do, but it's going to know how to heal itself. And I know that no doctor would be like, I think you should go do that. But if you do the nutrition, if you pace, if you train, you still can do these pretty remarkable things with your body. And so
are you surprised at, not, you're probably not surprised, not the right word now, but one of the things that I've been fascinated since I was a little fat kid was, is, you know, human potential is the way that the mind and the body can create amazing outcomes, and the way that people can overcome incredible adversity, whether or not it's self-inflicted adversity or situation or circumstance adversity. But Are you amazed, because you must meet some other people that are incredible, are you amazed at what human beings can do when we open the door on our potential and we kind of hit the accelerator and red line a little bit, how much crazy stuff we can do?
Oh, absolutely. And like, I never thought I could run 1 mile, right? And like, I hated team sports because I felt like it wasn't fun and it was like a little too stressful. And so I had to take a gym class and to get my like high school diploma. And so I took a running walking class so I could just walk and get an easy A. And so I was on the complete opposite side of the spectrum of like, sporty things go away. I don't want to bother someone else. And so I really had no idea what our bodies were capable of doing. And so when I ran a mile, which was like the first time I had ever, like I was already forced to be in that class. So I was like, well, I might as well try to run because everyone else is, and maybe I can do it. And I mean, the first mile I ever ran, I think is similar to most people. It's like, you're out of breath. You don't know how to pace yourself. Your lungs might feel like they're on fire. Like, but I left with a renewed sense of like, wow, our bodies can do these things. And my mantra or my way to and through endurance is just this curiosity. Like kids are very curious. They climb trees, they jump over rocks, they're constantly exploring the world and having that explorer's mindset. And I think that's what is also really alluring about endurance, is you can reconnect with that curiosity. And it's not so much of like, you know, overcoming, or as much as it is about discovering, like.
And yeah, are you a curiosity to your family, or are there more of you? Like, are your parents like, your mum bloody conquered Everest at 14, and your dad, you know, ran a lot across Alaska or something?
My mom is like, so I'm okay with 30-foot waves and sharks, and my mom is afraid of driving on the freeway, so she only takes side roads. So like,
so there's no genetic component.
I don't know. My mom never took anti-anxiety medicine, but I probably was more, you know, reason enough for her to want to. But no, but they understand now. Like, they still know that that's how I, you know, live and breathe. But yeah, you asked about the mental side. I definitely think like the running across Maine in 33 hours was more physically challenging than rowing across the Atlantic. However, rowing across the Atlantic was way more difficult mentally, because very rarely in life do you make a decision that, like, unless you decide to enlist to go to war, unless you like do things that knowingly might give you cancer, like most people don't. Like, as a 19-year-old, I was making a decision when I knew half of the people didn't make it. And I knew that I was making a decision about doing something that I could die doing. And that was the real mental challenge of like, I spent the last 3 months like thinking about, okay, this might be the last time, this might be the last Christmas, this might be the last, like, that was really challenging. And being in the airport and being like, we all knew with tears in our eyes that like, it might be the last time we see each other. And that was like really hard for me. And I did work with a sports psychologist, but yeah.
So
that's not something I had to worry about running across Maine. Like,
when somebody's prepared to, you know, not prepared to die, but prepared to accept the risk and the challenge that, well, there's, you know, I'm much more likely to die doing this than staying home. and people do die doing challenges like that. And also half the people fail. There has to be an incredible level of motivation. What is that about? Like, You that's not like something that you kind of want to do, or you go, oh, we'll just see how we go. I mean, that needs to almost be an overwhelming obsession.
Absolutely. And for me, I definitely believe in calling. Like, when something seems so audacious, so big, so beyond logic, like it's a calling, like there's no, I mean, I did everything to talk myself out of it. I was like, the last American woman to try, she failed. Like, it took her three times and she was an Olympic rower. So I was really in my head, like, who am I to think I could do this? And I think sometimes what happens is when we choose between A and B, we look for the easy option. What's the easier option? That's kind of human nature. And for rowing or not rowing the Atlantic, there was no easy option because there was either the fear of the ocean or the fear of regret. And yeah. Regret is a slow death in its own. Day after day, ignoring your calling and having that lingering feeling that, and that becomes habit, right? Like if you die to your calling, then the rest of your life, you continue to die to your calling and that becomes second nature just to stuff it in. And I made the decision that, yeah, I was either going to row the Atlantic or spend the rest of my life wondering why I didn't. So 70 days seemed the easier of whatever, maybe 70 years. So regret is not easy. And I think regret would have been harder to live with than to live and, you know, die doing what I felt called to do.
It's interesting because I think with, you know, there's a lot of variables and a lot of components to what you did. But to me, there's two obvious components. And one is the physical, practical, external world, you know, the preparation, the physiology, the food, the planning, the tools, the boat, the support, there's all that. So there's the practical journey, but there's also the inner journey. You know, there's the emotional, spiritual, psychological journey. Because you had two journeys, right? So there's the seen journey and the unseen journey. And I think that the practical journey is evident. So you rode, I think, what was it? 4,899 kilometers, you know, nearly 5,000 kilometers, which is crazy. But what interest, and that's fascinating and that's unbelievable. And I want to know more about that, but I want to know like who you became because, you know, I think like in life, we've never met everyone before this call, you know, Katie and I have never spoken, but a lot of the stuff I talk about, Katie, is, you know, taking on challenges and learning and growing and putting ourselves in situations that aren't necessarily what we want, but what we need. And, you know, so there's ticking boxes and running races and rowing oceans and building businesses or overcoming addictions or whatever. So there's all that practical stuff, but then there's the inner journey of who we become along the way, because when you kind of go where you grow, then you are, yes, you're doing all these incredible feats and you're raising money for awesome causes, but you're becoming a weapon. You know, you're building resilience and mental and emotional strength and understanding and awareness. And, you know, you're literally becoming a different version of you. Is that part of it for you?
I don't try to put expectation, but of course, I think if you're pushing yourself, growth is the byproduct. Like, I don't know, I guess a big like change for me being athletic and doing athletic things is like, there's process and product goals. Like product goals may say, I want to run a 5K in under 20 minutes. And then the process goal says, I want to work out three times a week doing these intervals. And I've become more focused on the process instead of the product. But I can say that there's a lot of things that the row taught me. It taught me that, first of all, I was like, oh, if you're alone, you're going to go crazy. And that's kind of what we assume, that lonely, or, you know, alone means lonely.
Yeah.
But for me, I still felt connected. And that was a beautiful thing to know that you could be in the most remote part in the world and still feel the love of your friends and family, and like that they're so with you no matter where you go. And then there's definitely a different relationship with feelings. Like, before I started doing a lot of these endurance challenges, or in the early stages, I would be like very startled about feeling like the feeling of wanting to quit. Like, generally, if you push yourself to these limits, that will pop up. And that's kind of part of the journey and the process. And I used to jump to conclusions about that. Like, I feel like quitting. So that means, I would panic and think that means I probably am going to quit, or I should quit. If I feel that way, then doesn't that mean? And so coming face to face with those feelings on a regular basis, they started to lose their grip on me. It's just, it doesn't mean that I am, you know, weak. It just means that this is hard. And that's just to be expected, rather than hit the panic button and run away. It just means that you're doing something challenging. And so I didn't look at those as problems, or just process. And so, I mean, even my last run across Maine, I freaked out with 5 miles to go because someone told me I had 7 more miles. So
oh, really?
I was like on the side of the road, because it was so painful with the edema that the idea of 2 more miles was enough to put me over the edge. So I was definitely on the side of the road, ripping up grass and throwing it and crying. And I felt great afterwards. And so I think endurance helps you laugh those and just indulge and laugh about it, but still know that you can keep going, and you could let yourself. Sometimes it's like feelings are just meant to be felt, not followed. And endurance, because you go into these really low spots and learn to just sit with them or let them pass. And endurance is full of highs and lows. And whenever I have like longer runs, my race report or my run report is usually just, it was fun until it wasn't, and then it got fun again. And that's usually it. It's usually, most of the part is fun. Usually is not fun for a little bit, but then you go through it and it's fun again.
So here's my random question. So Joe's podcast is called The Joe Rogan Experience. What was your Joe Rogan experience? What was it like? What was it like being on the biggest podcast on the planet?
I was nervous. Like, it was definitely, I mean, I was just surprised he didn't ask me more about what I've been up to since the row.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he knew that there were a lot of other adventures but yeah, I mean, I thought he was fun and, yeah, it was definitely not something I expected. So
did you pick up a lot of, I don't know, followers or interest or beyond that?
I am relatively new to social media. So
come on, Katie, what are you doing? Get on board. Come on.
I had it and then I deleted it at one point. But I just got it back like a year ago. So Yeah, there's more followers now that I have Facebook and Instagram. So that's cool.
Tell us about your 11 ultras in 11 days. What's that about? How long is each? Are they all the same distance?
Yes. So they're all going to be 50Ks, and it will be like, there's been other people who have done the consecutive marathons, and sometimes they're done doing races, and then other times I've seen them done on tracks. But yeah. I think it's a shame not to do adventure and explore. So I'm planning on doing this run from my home state in Ohio, and there's this trail that's 341 miles from Cincinnati, Ohio to Cleveland, Ohio. So it's this trail called the Ohio to Erie Trail, and it starts at one source, the Ohio River, one source of water, and ends at one of the Great Lakes, Lake Erie. So one of my friends is coming to follow in her like conversion van, and it will be 50K every day until, you know, reaching the other side of the state, with the goal of raising funds for 11 water projects in Uganda in partnership with H2O for Life.
Tell us about, tell us about your projects. Tell us about raising funds, and tell us about those causes that you're passionate about.
Yeah. So I was studying at Deakin University in Australia, and one of my professors for environmental science, she just mentioned very casually about like the wars of the future will be on water. And in some countries it's already the case. And that was a one sentence that forever changed my life. And I didn't know anything about the water crisis. At that time, 1 in 6 people or 1 billion people didn't have clean water. And I just thought about all the people that I've met in the 20 years of my life, or 19 years at the time. And of all the people that I've met in all those 19 years, did I ever meet anyone who didn't have clean water? And the answer was no. And I felt so ignorant, and I felt so angry about like, how is that even possible? We have iPhones and all these, you know, houses, yeah. And to imagine not having water is such an injustice. And then there's also hope. Hope was on the other side of it, because they're doing it. Charities are doing it. And it's really a matter of funding, and it doesn't take a whole lot. $50 is enough to help some of these projects get clean water for life. And I couldn't imagine a cause making as an impact as water, because it does help with health, education, women empowerment. Like kids are able to go to school instead of collect water. Kids are able to stay in school and not be sick at home. And it's just really cool to see that change and transformation is real. And it really doesn't take a whole lot to do that. So it was definitely an easy cause to want to get behind. And
Amazing. Good for you. Now, where do you live? By yourself? Are you married? Do you live with your folks? Like, what's the deal?
So I am in the Coast Guard, which means that I do kind of move around a bit, but I do live on my own right now. I used to do van life. That was real fun. But
van life. What's the Coast Guard like? So are you a firefighter? Is that what you are?
Oh, I was in Station Buffalo. Enlisted, and then I got picked up for officer candidate school. So I graduated from that in 2019. And this is my first tour as an officer. So I'm in the response department and doing incident management. And so right now for the first tour for all Coast Guard officers, it's really a training tour. So the 2-3 years are primarily focused on getting different qualifications. So right now, I finished up a boat crew qualification, learning how to do everything on the boats, the basics. And then right now I'm working on a pollution qualification to know what to do and how to respond to the pollution cases.
Did you tell them that you have a background in boats?
Well, not a whole lot transferred over, because rowboats are very different, but
hey, can I just ask a bit about the practical? So maybe some of our listeners want to know. I kind of don't want to ask these questions, because I feel like you've answered them 1,000 times, but I've never asked them and you've never told us. So your ocean crossing was 70 days. Is that correct?
That's right.
Did you take 70 days of food, or were there drop-offs, or I don't know, how does that work? So tell us a little bit about the logistics of eating, sleeping, navigating, 30-foot waves. Tell us a little bit about some of the practical and logistical challenges of doing that.
Well, if you're a rower, you might hate ocean rowing. We'll start with that, because if you've ever rowed on a rowing machine, yeah, that's what I did. I had a sliding seat. However, with all the waves, rowing an ocean rowboat is like trying to row while riding a bull. Like, you're constantly reading the waves and timing every oar stroke so you don't like crack your ribs or jab your knees. So it wasn't graceful. It was very cumbersome. So I had everything on that boat, and it was 19 feet. It was 400 pounds without provisions, but once it was fully loaded, it was 1,000 pounds.
Wow.
And so the most important thing was my desalinator. So I did not need to carry all the water, and the desalinator was powered by 2 solar panels. So that powered the most energy intensive thing was definitely the desalinator, but then it was powering my radio and GPS, and had spare oars, spare water maker, pretty much spares of everything. And then for food, it was all these freeze dried meals. Like, it wasn't like the MREs where there's liquid in it. I made sure to keep the weight low. And then I had protein powders, 300 chocolate bars, a sprouting kit so that I could grow some fresh stuff. I had 100 letters from my mom that she wrote for every day I would spend at sea. And there was no follow boat. There was no helicopter. It wasn't, there weren't many boats out there. So I probably saw another boat or freighter once a week, if that.
Wow.
And I did have like 25, 30 foot waves at the end. And it was when I was about 100 miles away from reaching land. So I ended up rowing 2 countries west of my original destination, like 400 more miles, because I wanted it to be unassisted. And if I would have kept going and trying to be really precise, I would have needed a boat to tow me in. Otherwise, I wouldn't have reached exactly where I needed to be. So I did end up having a little detour, because if I kept rowing, I'd have a better chance because the currents and the conditions were better than they were in French Guiana. So instead of French Guiana,
how do you sleep?
Not very well. So if there's one regret that I have, it'd be that I didn't pack like 2 beanie bag chairs so that I could like stuff myself into bed. So I did have 2 straps that I would strap myself into bed so that if the boat flipped, I would help with the self-righting. But it was almost like a coffin-sized cabin. You could sit up in it, and I would sleep in my cabin. But because I was rowing near the equator, I was really hot. It was like a little sauna in there, and you had to close the hatch, otherwise it wouldn't be self-righting. So I had like a 4-inch fan, and so it was very hot. And then just rocking all the time, I would wake up, and then flying fish would hit my cabin. So I was waking up all the time, and I definitely, there comes a point where if your body doesn't get sleep, it's like, fine. And then it doesn't sleep anymore. So I definitely had insomnia. And even after I landed, it took me, I don't know, a couple weeks, a month for me to, and it took me a month to heal, because any like open, like, you know, blisters, if you're constantly being hit by waves and constantly wet, nothing heals. So I didn't, just like, you know, from chafing or whatever, it took me a bit of time.
Wow.
And walking, I couldn't walk straight. I looked like I was intoxicated every time I was walking after the row, just because I wasn't used to using those muscles. And
and you're also in hip flexion for 70 days, you know, because you're sitting, like, you're not you're not, other than when you're sleeping, I guess, but the majority of the time that you're there, could you, this is a weird question, but I'm just thinking, well, you probably couldn't, but could, was there any way to stand up in the boat, even just
Oh, you could. In the cockpit, It wasn't like, if you tried to stand, it'd be more like surfboard. Like,
you were,
like, that was another thing, like cooking or brushing your teeth. Brushing your teeth takes probably 3 to 5 times longer when you're rocking and moving and swaying and having to brace yourself. And I mean, I didn't mind most days. I think when I was really exhausted, I was like, maybe I could not do that. But
did you ever, this is a stupid question, I'm sure the answer is no, did you ever get out of the boat and into the water?
Wait, why is that? That's a great idea. Like, I know that sharks live there. However, it was like 90 degrees. So I was afraid to go in, but I was also extremely hot. And there aren't many rules about ocean rowing, but if you look at them, one of them is that you can't have a canopy to protect you from the sun because it could be considered a sail. So I was very hot and very exposed. So I would jump in the water, one, to cool off, two, to scrub barnacles, and three, to visit my friends. Like, I had fish that followed. Some of these Dorados I named Ed, Ed, and Eddie because they kept following underneath my boat. But fish are curious, so they just kind of follow along if something's floating on the...
So did you and the fish talk much, or...?
I mean, I'm not much of a talker, but I appreciated their presence.
If they were talking back to you, that's what I want to hear about.
All the hallucinations happen on running, not rowing.
What's your event of a lifetime? What's your pie? Your What is it, pie in the sky? What's your, or was the Atlantic crossing it? Is there some big thing that you want to do before you hang it up?
Oh, yeah. So the whole point of the rowing across the Atlantic was I wanted to go around the whole entire world with muscles. Like, I didn't want to use sails. I didn't want to use anything but human power. So as a 18, 19-year-old, I said, well, what's the hardest part? What's the part where people fail? Because I would hate to spend that whole journey, like, really having that. I mean, I think that's normal. Like, you do the hardest part first so you can enjoy. And so that's why I did the row. Most people do the row from islands to islands, like the Canaries to the Caribbean, because you're already in the trade winds and you already have the currents helping you along. So I went continent to continent with the intention of continuing on. So I wanted to spend my 20s doing Ironmans and doing things. Like, part of me thinks that I've read about and seen people who do these around the world trips when they're 60, and a lot of my ultra cycling friends are like dudes in their 60s and even 70s. So I had other priorities, and I think for my 20s, I already knew that I could do endurance, and I wanted to start a nonprofit, work for nonprofits, join the military. And so I think I am very aware that now that I'm in my 30s, that I'm probably at my peak for recovery. And yep. I think going around the world, the next leg is cycling from South to North America. And I do think that after my tour is up next year, so I think next year is when I'm planning on starting the next leg. Mm. So that'd be the 12,000-mile cycle from where I landed in the row up to Alaska.
I was reading somewhere that you were going to do a big ride. I can't remember the ride. I know that you rode across the States.
Yes.
Riding 85 miles a day for 40 days. But you were going to do another event. I don't have it in front of me, but you broke your hip or something not long before. And so you did it, but using An upper body bike?
Yeah.
Hey, here's, look, I'm no expert, but here's an idea. Have some time off.
No, it was, we already all, it was part of a race. It's called Race Across America. It's a race that they host every year in June.
Mm.
And I had been training for 8 months and my teammate was already like flying in, and it was already like a big crew and a film team, and there were a lot of other like factors in making that decision. But I was always really inspired by seeing people who would come to races and be on hand bikes, and the story is the same, that it's all about overcoming setbacks. So even if I can't walk, I could still use my arms.
But what's funny though is all of your training was with your legs.
Correct. Like you let your arms wither away to nothing.
And then you, like you were, on an aerobic level, you were prepared, but from a muscular endurance level, not at all.
Yeah, that's how I got the nickname, was it Hamster Girl or Gerbil Girl? Because it's not cute. You look, but I had upper body from the row.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true.
We definitely had to, it was as a team. So it was supposed to be a 2-person effort and it ended up being 4. And so some other friends helped, and there's no way we would have made it across without their help. And we had to really be strategic about how I would ride, because if there was any incline, I would be going 5 miles per hour of that. And then if there was a steep decline, I'd be flying away. So I was mainly on the flats.
What if you compare riding, rowing, running, and swimming, which you do all of, is there anything else that I'm missing? What else?
Rollerblading.
Oh, dude, come on. What is this, 1988? Come on, get out of there. What are you
Bring
doing?
Bring it back.
Come over, Katie. I've been looking for a rollerblading buddy for years.
Really? You like rollerblading?
Yes, I love it.
It's the best.
We were massively into rollerblading for a while. We had some of the best rollerbladers in the world. I used to train a guy called Paul Molina, who used to do, you know, the vert ramp, you know, the pipe. Yeah. And they used to have this thing called, nobody needs to know this, but they used to do this where they'd come in and then they'd do a high jump and jump over. So he was like the best in the world at that anyway. But so are you still rollerblading now?
I am. I actually am in the process of moving, and I dropped off some stuff yesterday and it was all my like cycling gear. And I noticed that my rollerblades were there, and I'm moving the rest of it on Friday. And I was just like, I don't know if I could be 5 days without them, but I left them there. So I think that when you do cycling and running, you're going forward, you're not using your hips. And there's a lot of muscle imbalances when you do these repetitive forward motion sports. Plus sometimes running and even cycling can get a little intense, and that's why I like ultra running, because most of the ultra runners that I know, I remember the one of the 100 milers that I did, the cutoff time is 24 to 36 hours or something like that. So I remember finishing 100 miles and no one even noticed. Like, and that's kind of beautiful that the end isn't this glorified thing, because it makes you realize every moment is just as special as that last one. Mm. So I do think out of all the distances, ultra runners are the most chill, but you could take it a little too, at least for me with Ironmans, I took it way too seriously, and always wearing the heart rate monitor and working with the coach. And it was great to get faster and see that kind of progress, but it also took some of that joy away. And I don't know. I don't, I've never rollerbladed and been in a bad mood, so I'm all about it.
Well, there you go. Maybe that's the, maybe it's going to make, like yo-yos, maybe it's going to make a comeback. What, in terms of outside of being in the military and doing all your stuff, you do, I imagine you do, or maybe I'm wrong, but you do a fair bit of speaking, do you, with kids or schools or businesses or?
So I did do a lot with H2O for Life. So we reached out to 100,000 students, and the intention behind that was definitely motivational and inspirational, but also to help them become water warriors and help them kind of pass on that, the baton, for them to do something about clean water, because a lot of kids were very inspired to do something, and H2O for Life helped provide them with those service learning opportunities. And they're different than a lot of different water charities, because it's not just, I think it's easy to see we're helping in different countries. We're helping in Uganda. We're helping in India. We're helping, but there's a real need for kids in more developed countries to feel like they're part of something bigger, to develop empathy, to have care and concern, to, I mean, with depression and suicide. And I think H2O for Life does something, and service learning opportunities in general, does something very meaningful for kids that are seeking purpose. And so they do give those types of resources, and we'll partner with schools regardless of their fundraising goal or how much or how little. So I definitely have to balance it out, just because right now with the 11 ultras in 11 days, I'm training at least 2 hours a day and then working. So I do have like leave that I can do speaking, but there's not much more time.
Yeah.
Much else.
What, since that 19-year-old student got told by that dude at Deakin in, where were you studying? Deakin where, in Melbourne?
Yes.
That's where we're at, dude.
So cool.
Yeah, it's the best, isn't it? Since he told you, was it a he or a she? A he?
The teacher was a woman. And then the place I found out about ocean rowing was also right. Australia. So that was a dude.
So the lady who told you about the stats on clean drinking water or clean water and accessibility for people across the globe, I think you said it's like 1 million people didn't have access to clean water then. Was that right?
A billion.
A billion. How is it now?
It's about, I think, 884 million. So right. It has gone down.
It has gone down, and the population, the global population has gone up. So as a percentage, it's improving. Well, that's a good thing. Well, we appreciate you. We're going to let you go and do whatever you need to do. One of those 500, you're probably going to roll. Oh, your rollerblades are in transit, are they?
Yeah, they're at my new place.
You're going to need some therapy. If people want to connect with you or follow you, now that you're a social media, you know, megastar, how do people follow you or connect with you or support your causes? What would you like to plug?
Oh yeah. So I'm on Instagram and Facebook. Instagram is just Katie Spotz, KATIESPOTZ. And Facebook's just Hello Katie Spotz. And the 11 projects in Uganda, I think we've funded 2 of them, but we are still looking to fund the rest. So you could donate by going to katiespotz.com, and there's a link there, and 100% goes directly to H2O for Life.
So. Awesome. You're the best. Well, Katie, thanks for talking to us on the U Project. We appreciate your time, and you're an inspiration, and keep doing all those good things for people, because you've got a purpose and a project bigger than yourself, which we love.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Stay on the call if you would for one sec. Tiff, good work, you.
She's amazing, isn't she?
She is amazing, but let's not talk about her while she's listening. Let's wait till she's gone, then we'll chat about her. Thanks, everyone. Love you guts. See you next time.